The headlines. Qatar calls on Persian Gulf Arab countries to hold talks with Iran, describing it as a desire shared by other Arab states. The Iranian Army's Brown Force holds military exercises in the south of the country. And the number of coronavirus cases in the U.S. tops 24 million as the world's worst-hit country approaches 400,000 COVID deaths. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. Qatar has called on Persian Gulf Arab countries to hold talks with Iran to resolve disputes. Foreign Minister Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdul Rahman Al Thani said that he is hopeful that such talks will happen. He said this is also a desire shared by other members of the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council. The top Qatari diplomat said that his country will facilitate the negotiations if asked by stakeholders. Last month, GCC members Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and the UAE reestablished diplomatic ties with Qatar after breaking them off in June 2017. The trio broke the ties at that time partly because of Qatar's relations with Iran. Tehran has repeatedly said that it is open to any initiative that helps ease tensions in the Persian Gulf region. The Iranian army has once again staged a military exercise in the country's south. This time, the ground forces of the army showed off their capabilities amid heightened tensions with the U.S. over its presence in the region. The correspondent Human Abedi has attended the drills.
The ground forces of Iran's army kicked off war games along the Makran coasts of the Sea of Oman, southeast of Iran. The drills called Iqtedar or Power 99 started with the participation of airborne units, special forces, and quick reaction units. The troops received logistical and combat support from the Air Force and the Army Ground Forces Airborne Division at the coastal zones in Hormozgan province. A combination of homegrown and creative military tactics was practiced in the offense exercise based on the new structure of the ground forces.
The main purpose of the war games is to evaluate the mobility and offense power of the Rapid Reaction Forces and Corps and the mobile offense units of the Army Ground Forces. They also practice rapid and decisive response to threats on the hypothetical enemy's coasts.
We talked to Iran's Army Commander Major General Abdulrahim Mousavi, who attended the drills, asking him if the extensive war games are in reaction to U.S. deployment of forces to the region in recent weeks.
It seems that the Americans are somehow confused and are suffering from indecisiveness. This is the first time in the U.S. history that they are in a very inappropriate condition. Our drills are generally preemptive, but as they may make some insane moves, we stage these maneuvers to say we are ready against any calculation error by the adversaries.
We also talked to the war games commanders, who gave more details regarding the drills on the land and at the sea.
Our parachuters descended from planes and then got on armored personnel carriers to approach the mock enemy targets and destroy them. In another part of the exercise, some special forces and divers will descend from choppers on the sea surface to get to the beach and fight mock enemy forces.
The Iranian military forces have held several massive maneuvers over the past few weeks. The importance of this year's drills conducted by the Army's forces relies on the native nature of the equipment used in the event. Almost all of the equipment used in the war games this year are homegrown. Human Abedi, JOSC.
Earlier we were joined by the spokesman for the ongoing Iranian military drills. Qumas Sharafi gave us more details about the exercises.
These drills featured an operation, a joint airborne operation by Brigade 55 of the Airborne Division of the Land Force using transport planes from the farthest point in the country. And these operations featured parachuters of Airborne Division's land, and they conducted a joint airborne operation successfully. The operation was conducted successfully. One of the features of these maneuvers is the transportation operations, airborne transportation. Rapid reaction forces and special forces also took part, and given the actually threats that the country is facing. And we, in these drills, we managed to very quickly, we managed to conduct operations in an area which has been designated for the drills, and we conducted land operations as well.
Let's go back to our other story here regarding how Qatar may play the role of a mediator if that were to happen with Iran and other countries of the Persian Gulf region. Laith Maruf is an activist and political commentator who joins us. You know, this all sounds good on the surface, but I'm guessing that there are many points of differences that will prevent something like this from happening. One of them, for example, is the fact that the UAE has established ties with Israel.
Yes, and obviously Qatar has had under the table and at sometimes very open relationships with Israel. And we have to remember that the Obama-Biden team prior to Trump were responsible with the help of Qatar and its media propaganda arm Al Jazeera and Turkey of creating the Arab Autumn that brought in Muslim Brotherhood control in many countries before, obviously, Saudi Arabia revolted against that. So Qatar is returning to its original role that was there 5 years ago before Trump came into power, which is to play this hidden role of providing support for imperial positions in the region under the guise of supposed democracy and representation. So Iran has to be very careful from engaging in something like this and wasting another 5-6 years of negotiation with the U.S. while the United States gets to rearrange its forces in the region to confront the axis of resistance.
I'm looking at some of the statements made by Iran's President Hassan Rouhani, in particular the one that happened at the 74th session of the UN General Assembly regarding establishing regional security in the region. Of course, that would be a precondition for that to happen, for the U.S. not to be involved in the region, and also how Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has said pretty much the same thing. The statement coming from Qatar is very interesting, where it says that there's an interest from other countries of the Persian Gulf region to have this relationship with Iran, based on what Qatar has said. Now, in that case scenario, what would break the impasse that exists currently between Iran and other countries for a relationship of sorts to get established?
You see, the actual strategic difference between Iran and the Gulf states is that Iran is looking to be a sovereign country that is outside the control and domination of Western imperialism and is strategically against the existence of apartheid Israel as a colony in the heart of the region. That is cannot be actually the Gulf states. Their own strategic goals is to be in within the Western imperialist order. So these two things, they can't be consolidated. And so any talk outside that strategic difference is just a waste of time. And it's very clear from the last few months and the rush of all these Gulf states to come into full strategic alliance with Israel against Iran and the resistance of Axis before Trump leaves, this shows that there's no compromise.
All right, Bill, well, thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. Laith Maruf there, activist and political commentator from Beirut. Thanks for your comments. Iran's ambassador to the UN has called on all the signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal to uphold their end of the bargain. In an interview, Majid Takht-e Rawanchi pointed to U.S. obligations under the International Accord and UN Resolution 2231, which endorsed the agreement. He said not only the U.S., but the European parties must also respect their commitments under the deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. The Iranian diplomat said the administration of U.S. President-elect Joe Biden must lift all sanctions mentioned in Resolution 2231, adding that Tehran won't accept Washington meeting its obligations halfway.
Over the past few years, the U.S. has changed the name of some of the sanctions that were lifted under the JCPOA. For example, it has renamed the sanctions imposed on Iran's central bank. This is not our problem. It's up to the Americans to solve their problems. It's unacceptable for us to hear them say, we will comply with the JCPOA, but we won't lift these sanctions because they have been recategorized.
Takhtar Awanchi further said that Iran will go back to full compliance with its obligations under the deal once all parties do the same. The U.S. withdrew from the JCPOA in 2018 and reimposed unilateral sanctions on Iran. Tehran, in return, announced a gradual scale-back of its commitments, citing the remaining signatories' failure to meet their obligations. Total deaths from coronavirus in the U.S. are approaching 400,000. That's according to the latest data by the country's Johns Hopkins University. The U.S. death toll is higher than that of any country in the world. The U.S. also has the largest infection tally, with more than 24 million cases. Currently, California is the hardest-hit U.S. state by the pandemic. On Monday, it became the first American state to record more than 3 million COVID infections. Meanwhile, multiple states have reported cases of the new COVID variant first detected in the U.K. That has raised concerns, even though daily infections have been trending down in the U.S. over the past week. In France, the average daily coronavirus infections have hit over a six-week high, with more than 18,000 confirmed cases. Unlike Britain or Germany, the French government has stopped short of imposing a third national lockdown. However, a nationwide curfew remains in place to curb the surge in cases. France has so far reported over 70,000 deaths out of more than 2.9 million cases. Meanwhile, the UK has closed its travel corridors until February 15 to curb the spread of a new COVID variant as Europe keeps struggling with a second wave of the pandemic. In Germany, the health minister says while the infection numbers seem to be decreasing, the country is still not stable.
We see both in the infection numbers, which seem to be going down where we look at the last few days, as well as the situation in the intensive care units, where there are 10 to 15% fewer COVID-19 patients now than at the peak. That seems to be moving in the right direction, but we are still a long way from where we need to be.
German authorities have registered over 7,000 new cases, taking the total infections to over 2 million. The virus has also so far claimed more than 47,000 lives in the country. Elsewhere in Europe, Italy registered nearly 9,000 new cases and 377 more deaths. The country has logged over 82,000 deaths so far, the second highest in Europe. Portugal's daily death toll from the virus also reached a record high of 167 on Monday, bringing the total to over 9,000. The country has been under a lockdown since last week, with hospitals struggling to cope with soaring contagion. The World Health Organization says the world faces a catastrophic moral failure because of unequal COVID vaccine policies.
I need to be blunt. The world is on the brink of a catastrophic moral failure. And the price of this failure will be paid with lives and livelihoods in the world's poorest countries.
The WHO chief said that over 39 million doses of vaccine have been distributed in at least 49 higher-income nations. That is while he said one poor country had only received 25 doses. He called on all countries to work together to ensure that medical workers and the elderly get vaccinated in the first 100 days of this year. Vaccination has started in some countries with already authorized COVID vaccines. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has urged Israel to halt and reverse its recent plan to build new settler units in the occupied West Bank. Guterres said that Israel's settlement construction in the Palestinian territory, occupied since 1967, has no legal validity. He said such activities are a flagrant violation under international law. According to the UN chief, Israel's expansionism further erodes the possibility of ending the occupation and establishing a Palestinian state. Israel approved the construction of 780 new settler units on Sunday, following an order by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. An Israeli settlement watchdog has said that most of the units will be built deep in the West Bank. All Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories are illegal under international law. Human Rights Watch has called on Israel to provide Palestinians with the coronavirus vaccines. In a statement, the international body said that the Israeli regime must ensure the vaccines are equally provided to the Palestinians in order to meet its obligations under international law. Ashraf Shannon has more in this report.
An international rights group says that Israel, as an occupying power, must provide coronavirus vaccines to Palestinians. According to a press release by Human Rights Watch on Sunday, the Israeli authorities should provide COVID-19 vaccines to Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Human Rights Watch Regional Director Omar Shakir said that while Israel has already vaccinated more than 20% of its citizens, including Jewish settlers in the occupied West Bank, it has not committed to vaccinate Palestinians living in the same occupied territory under its military rule. Israeli authorities had, as of January 14, 2021, provided doses of the vaccine to more than 2 million Israeli citizens. Close to 150,000 coronavirus infections and over 1,500 deaths have been reported in the occupied West Bank and the blockaded Gaza Strip so far.
Article 56 of the 4th Geneva Convention requires Israel, as an occupying power, to adopt and apply the prophylactic and preventive measures necessary to combat the spread of contagious diseases and epidemics. The provision of COVID-19 vaccine to Palestinians is the duty of the Israeli occupying forces. Israel bears full responsibility for the health and well-being of people under its occupation.
Palestinians have accused the Israeli regime of practicing medical apartheid against them and committing mass human rights violations. Experts say Tel Aviv must end its discriminatory policies and remove any barriers that may hinder Palestinians from accessing or enjoying health care.
Ban Human Rights Watch.
The statement by Human Rights Watch echoes the position of many international human rights organizations as it exposes the ugly face of the Israeli occupation. It also exposes the grave human rights violation by the Israeli regime, especially violating the health rights of Palestinians. Israel, as an occupying power, must meet its obligations under international laws and norms.
Human rights groups are expressing alarm over Israel's decision not to vaccinate more than 4.5 million Palestinians living in the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip, depriving them of their right to health care.
Under the 4th Geneva Convention, the Israeli regime must ensure medical supplies to Palestinians, including combating the spread of pandemics. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
More bad news for the outgoing U.S. president. A new poll shows Donald Trump's approval rating has plunged to the lowest as he prepares to leave office. According to a Gallup poll, a whopping 66% of Americans disapproved of the way that Trump is handling the presidency. Just 34% of those surveyed approved of his job. Trump had an average 41% approval rating throughout his presidency, which is 4 points lower than for any of his predecessors. His role in inciting a violent mob that stormed the Capitol and a second House impeachment are reasons behind his dwindling popularity. The new poll comes just 2 days before President-elect Joe Biden takes office. While Trump is expected to issue around 100 pardons and commutations for his controversial allies and white-collar criminals during his remaining days. The Uganda government has accused the U.S. of attempting to subvert the last week presidential election and the will of the people. The reaction came after U.S. Ambassador Natalie Brown tried to visit Ugandan opposition leader Bobi Wine, who is now under house arrest. A government spokesman accused Brown of blatantly meddling in Uganda's internal politics. He said the American envoy had a track record of causing trouble in countries where she had worked in the past. The U.S. Embassy says that Brown was stopped from visiting the Ugandan opposition leader. The embassy has said that last week's vote was tainted by harassment of opposition candidates. The election saw incumbent Ugandan president extend his decades-long rule. Wine has accused him of fabricating the results. Tunisian police have clashed with demonstrators as nationwide protests against the police and an economic crisis enter the third night. Security forces used tear gas and water cannons to quell the protests in the capital, Tunis. The protesters were throwing stones, gasoline bombs, and burning tires at security forces. The demonstrations began on Friday after a video went viral showing an officer pushing a shepherd whose animals entered a government building. Police say that they have arrested over 1,000 people involved in the rioting. The protests also followed the 10th anniversary of a popular uprising that pushed former President Zine El Abidine Ben Ali from power. 10 years on, anger is growing at chronic joblessness and poor state services in the country. Meanwhile, President Kais Saied has asked people to stop violent protests, warning that some political forces are trying to sow chaos. That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
Fruit
Insightful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The reason why the Islamic Republic is opposed to negotiating with the U.S.
This is part of a televised speech delivered on July 31, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader of the Islamic Revolution on the occasion of Eid al-Adha.
In a few years, we will be needing at least 20,000 to 30,000 megawatts of electricity generated by nuclear energy. These needs cannot be fulfilled in the space of 6 months, 1 or 2 years. These needs should be satisfied in advance, and we have prepared the grounds for it. Despite the fact that we have suffered a great deal of loss because of the Barjam, the JCPOA, the essence is fortunately still there, and good and dazzling tasks are being accomplished in this regard. The enemy does not want this, though. The same is true of defense and missile areas. When the Americans say, "Let us negotiate," this is what they want to negotiate over. I strongly ask everyone to pay attention to this. Of course, I have repeatedly spoken about this, but I have to say it again because some people do not understand or pretend that they have not understood it.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
When the enemy says, "Let us negotiate," it means, come and sit at the negotiating table so that we will instruct you not to build missiles, which you have to accept, of course. If you accept their terms, well, you will be ruined as you have actually rendered yourselves defenseless. And if you do not accept their terms, there will be the same story. There will be more skirmishes, more sanctions, and more threats. This is what negotiation means.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. To Allah.
Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has held a two-day drill in central Iran. During the massive military exercises, the IRGC targeted and destroyed the mock enemy vessels in the Indian Ocean with long-range ballistic missiles. The first stage of the large-scale military exercise, codenamed the Great Prophet 15, kicked off on Friday. IRGC units launched a barrage of surface-to-surface ballistic missiles, which were followed by operations by offensive bomber drones. The missiles, equipped with detachable warheads, are guided from outer space and are able to penetrate into the enemy's missile shield. On the second day of the drills, the IRGC's missiles detected and destroyed the targets as they were sailing 1,800 kilometers away in a remote area in the ocean. A mixed attack involving a new generation of surface-to-surface ballistic missiles and drones was carried out, and all designated targets were destroyed with pinpoint accuracy. The mocked strikes were launched with the presence of the chairman of the Chief of Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Bagheri, who said that Iran does not intend to attack any country. However, he said the country's armed forces will respond with all might in the shortest time if any adversary had malicious intentions toward the Islamic Republic.
Choosing a barrage of long-range missiles against naval targets illustrates that if the enemies of the Islamic Republic have ill intentions against our national interests, maritime trade routes and territory, they will come under missile strike and will be destroyed.
Donald Trump had attempted through his sanctions, through the withdrawal of the JCPOA, to weaken Iran. This has not happened, and these exercises certainly demonstrate that. He had wanted Iran in a position that any of those countries, the United States, Israel, or Saudi Arabia, could successfully invade and attack and conquer Iran. But by these exercises, these military exercises that have recently been held, Iran has demonstrated that these sanctions have failed, that Iran remains a strong, powerful country dedicated to protecting its people, assisting its allies, and will certainly not surrender or give in to or be vulnerable to attack by its enemies.
The IRGC military exercises started shortly after the Iranian Navy finished its naval drills in the country's strategic southern waters. The drills are aimed at boosting the preparation and military prowess of the country's armed forces. The IRGC military exercise came after Iranian Navy's drills codenamed Ekhtedar-e-Daryayi 99. The two-day drills were held in the Sea of Oman and the Persian Gulf. A week prior to that, Iran held a massive drone maneuver across half of the country. These drills were launched amid heightened tensions between Iran and the U.S. in the final days of Donald Trump's presidency. Tensions have been simmering between the two countries in the past couple of months as the U.S. increases military presence in the region.
These exercises, I think, have been very important strategically for Iran in relation to the United States, because they have demonstrated, as I mentioned earlier, that the sanctions have not worked. So it is in the United States government under Joe Biden, it's in the U.S. government's interest to respect Iran, to re-enter the JCPOA, and to deal with Iran as another global citizen, trading with it, allowing trade with other countries, and working with it in a peaceful manner. These exercises have been a show of strength.
Last month, two U.S. B-52 bombers flew over the region. The move marked Washington's third dispatch of nuclear-capable bombers to the region in less than 2 months. The U.S. Navy had earlier announced the arrival of a nuclear-powered submarine in the Persian Gulf. The USS Georgia passed the Strait of Hormuz accompanied by two American warships, making it the first missile-loaded submarine of its kind to enter the region in 8 years. Analysts say these moves can signal Trump's intentions for triggering a conflict with Iran in his final days in office in order to distract attention from a string of failures in the past couple months. Many others say the outgoing U.S. president is simply seeking to complicate his successor's plans in coming back to the negotiating table with Iran over the nuclear deal. They say the U.S. president could be thinking about saddling President-elect Biden with some kind of military operation which could damage his efforts to come back to the JCPOA. Iran has time and again said its missile program is strictly for defensive purposes. However, Tehran says it will respond to any hostile action with a strong attack and maximum power.
The as more evidence comes to light as to just who was involved in the protests that saw five people die in the storming of the US Capitol building. It seems that many of those involved were serving or ex-military staff, raising the question as to just how right-wing the US actually leans. So serious is the situation that the Pentagon has launched a probe into extremist views from within the US military complex, as the body finally comes to terms and accepts that racism is rooted deep within the American system. Since the Pentagon has now acknowledged the problem, this raises the question as to whether the activities of those serving in the military and were part of the mob that broke into the Capitol actually broke more than just one law in the process.
Absolutely. In fact, these military officers that have been complicit, and it's not just the military, not just the Department of Defense, but also elected officials such as Senator Hawley, and also the police officers who we have seen on video leading these so-called insurrectionists into the Capitol, supporting them, taking photos with them. These are absolutely illegal and pose a big problem for the ruling class, because these people, these institutions, are the armed wing of the ruling class. They are there to protect the bourgeoisie. They are there to protect these elected officials and their rule of law.
However, the allegations are nothing new, as the US military has long been known to have racist views, as well as openly recruiting members of far-right or white supremacist groups. A report in the Guardian newspaper 6 months ago saw that the US military had already conducted a report into racism, showing that over a third of personnel had witnessed acts of racism in the service, a figure that's risen by some 14% since Trump took office. It also became apparent that many leaders within the white supremacists and far-right groups in the US were either serving or veterans of the US military, hence clearly linking the military-like discipline within such groups to the actual military body within the United States. Yet, as mentioned, this is nothing new, as the US has long displayed such traits. But what is apparent is the alarming and dramatic rise in such incidents, likely sparked by one very obvious catalyst. As Donald Trump finds himself ever more estranged from the grand old party and the presidency of the United States, his 4 years in the White House have left a legacy that no US president would be proud of, in particular when it comes to dealing with the diversity within his own nation. The endorsement of numerous acts of racial violence, discrimination and protest has left Trump leaving the White House having divided his nation. So many of his actions have actively encouraged and incited white supremacist groups to take a stand in the name of the so-called American Constitution. Trump also failed to deal with the Black Lives Matter protests following the murder of George Floyd by white police officers in Minneapolis. Had he done this promptly, it may just have given him another 4 years in the Oval Office. Trump has, in essence, created a divided and apartheid nation, something that incoming Joe Biden will no doubt have to reunite in his first term as president. However, with Trump very much still active in the background, the task is something that Biden must tackle head-on in order to resolve. With Trump having set the conditions to thrive, the question that now remains to be asked is whether Trump's legacy will lead to a civil or race war within the United States, whether he's in office or not.
Well, the empire is in decline, but it is not anywhere near ready to collapse. We might spend decades, we might spend maybe a year, but it will be time before the empire is collapsing and there will be those factions. The only future that the United States has is either a socialist one or a fascist one. And this battle will have to come eventually, but we're not anywhere near it yet. But the divisions are very deep.
Today I am calling on all Americans to...
Donald Trump has undoubtedly been the most controversial president of the United States. He has managed to make sworn enemies and inspire diehard supporters all across a divided America. His term in office is almost over now, but not the mixed feelings and fierce controversy surrounding the outgoing U.S. president. This week, Trump set a new record. He became the first ever American commander-in-chief to be impeached for a second time by the House of Representatives. Trump now faces trial in the Senate for allegedly inciting a group of his extremist supporters to violently attack Congress last week. In the worst possible scenario, he could be barred from ever holding public office again. That would practically mean the end of his political career. Back in 2019, Trump was impeached over his dealings with Ukraine, but finally acquitted by the Senate. This time, things could look a lot different, as a growing number of his fellow Republicans have said openly that the embattled president must be convicted. Trump has never been so isolated. Many members of his inner circle have either abandoned the lame duck president or seem to have distanced themselves from him. The outgoing president has also lost his cherished Twitter account, and many large corporations are boycotting him. Trump could be wiped off the face of U.S. politics, but his legacy will live on as dangerous divisions deepen in American society.
His main legacy for America is that he's the only president in the history, in American history, to have been impeached twice. Through his mismanagement and his ignorance, he allowed the COVID-19 pandemic to ravage this country, to decimate the economy, and he's the worst president in American history.
400,000 small. This is expected to complicate things for Joe Biden from day one in office.
That we're in the middle of the once in several generations economic crisis.
The United States will soon have a new president. Joe Biden will take office in the coming days. His upcoming swearing-in ceremony will, however, be different from any past presidential inauguration, all thanks to Trump. Security concerns intensified over the past week. Federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies are taking extraordinary measures to secure the ceremony in the capital of the nation. Authorities say they have received information indicating the possibility of more violence during the inauguration. The FBI, for instance, says armed protests are being planned all across America. More than 20,000 National Guard troops will be among the forces that will try to secure President-elect Joe Biden's swearing-in ceremony. Security forces say they want to prevent a repeat of last week's deadly insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. The developments of the past weeks in the U.S. have raised serious questions about the credibility of American democracy. Was Biden democratically elected? Authorities have found no evidence of irregularities. So why does Trump still insist that the November election was stolen? And why do so many millions of Americans still believe what he says? Some observers believe the post-election chaos in the United States shows a growing lack of trust in the system and elections.
That's evidence that the experiment called democracy right now isn't working. The fact that, well, on the one hand, the fact that we expect there to be a orderly transition of government is a good thing. But what we have to go through to ensure that there is an orderly transition of government does not bode well for America.
Biden will probably try to improve the situation, but the divisions in the United States are too deep and cannot be mended overnight.
So tonight, I'd like to talk to you about our way forward.
Many people around the world have highly condemned the brutal actions of the Israeli regime against the people of Palestine, whilst others have simply turned a blind eye to the actions of the regime, as it does not suit their foreign policy requirements. But when the criticism comes from within, surely it's time to take heed. In a piece in the UK Daily, The Guardian, Israeli human rights group B'Tselem director Shirai Elad slammed the Israeli regime's treatment of Palestine as apartheid control, which, coming from Israel's largest human rights group and a Jewish author, is something that has rocked Tel Aviv, who have quickly blunted the comments via its embassy spokesman in London, Ohad Zemet. Elad goes on to claim that the Israeli regime is working solely to advance the supremacy of one group of people, namely the Jews, which is most ironic, as the Jewish people themselves claim to have once been victims to such treatment, yet fail to back Elad's allegations when it's they who are at fault.
So bad has the situation become, from the controlling of land and sea borders in Gaza to the endless slicing away of land in the West Bank, that Elad claims there's not a single square inch of territory where the notion of equality can be claimed between Palestinians and Jews, suggesting clear favouritism towards the Jewish people. With Israel about to enter its fourth election in just 2 years, the rights and voices of the people of Palestine are being suppressed, mostly through the calculated engineering of power by the Israeli regime against Palestinians, be it through political rights or pure and simple denial of rights. But it seems that the people of Palestine are not simply standing back and allowing the Israeli regime to quietly push them into a corner, with regular voices and demonstrations still taking place, opposing the so-called deal of the century, opposing the destruction of Palestinian homes, and opposing the Israeli regime's ongoing attempts to steal more and more Palestinian land. In spite of the United Nations outlawing the Israeli regime from continuing to destroy Palestinian lands and occupy more Palestinian land in the process, the Israeli regime has brazenly ignored the law, hence both undermining an international organization such as the UN and the rights of the people of Palestine in the process. In fact, since the start of 2020, the Israeli regime has demolished over 700 Palestinian buildings, ranging from homes, schools, medical centres and community buildings, under the faux pretext of lacking construction permits, which is ironic, as they were all built on Palestinian land, hence raising the question as to just which Israeli regime permit could they possibly need. On top of the destruction of Palestinian homes and buildings, it's also the lives of the people of Palestine that the Israeli regime feels it so liberally able to take away. In 2020 alone, at least 27 Palestinian civilians were murdered in cold blood by the Israeli regime. Seven were children, proving that the execution of Palestinians is something that the Israeli regime is also getting away with scot-free. So poor and brazen is the behaviour of the Israeli regime that now even Jewish settlers are taking things into their own hands, emulating the crimes of their regime by raiding and attacking Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. In fact, in 2020 alone, 248 attacks were committed by settlers, all of which have again gone unpunished and unnoticed across the international community. With the normalisation of ties between the Israeli regime and Arab nations such as Bahrain, the UAE and Morocco, it seems that the voices of opposition are being deafened by the regime's false diplomacy, meaning that the people and land of Palestine is being wiped out by the Israelis, and equally as bad, being forgotten by their Arab brothers and sisters around the region.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
The first type of right that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam speaks about in his treatise is the right of God, the right of Allah, Haqqullah.
For Humanity, a commentary on Risalatul Huquq of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam.
By Hujjatul Islam, Zayd As-Salam.
Allah.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen, wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And welcome to IRIB English Radio and another program of For Humanity, where we are discussing the reciprocal rights, the treaties of rights of Imam Ali as-Sajjad Zain al-Abidin, peace be upon him. And in this Risalatul Huquq, he's speaking about the rights of who you interact with. We need to always be careful and cautious about who it is that we are interacting with and how we conduct ourselves in their presence. Because if I was to be someone who is careless about the common courtesy of what I need to do, then of course this means that I'm going to become a deceitful person, a hypocrite, a bad person, and all of these other negative features that Imam As-Sajjad, peace be upon him, has warned us and made sure that he explained that we avoid these kind of qualities in ourselves. If you want to be a person who you interact with as far as others are concerned, you need to make sure you do so in the best of ways, and you are going to be someone who is never oppressing anyone, never telling someone a lie, never cheating on anyone, and always make sure that you honor the rights of those who are around you. That being said, Imam As-Sajjad, peace be upon him, he says, وَلَا تَعْمَلْ فِي انْتِفَاضَةِ عَمَلِ الْعَدُوِ الَّذِي لَا يَبْقَى عَلَى صَاحِبِهِ. Now, this is the third part of the continuation of the segment of Imam As-Sajjad's section on interacting with others, and it means that you don't behave in such a way like as if you're dealing with an enemy. And of course, this segment is really, really surprising, because in reality it says that even though you might have short interaction with someone, you need to make sure that you don't do certain things, even though it may be as brief and quick. Look at your interests, look at your benefits, but don't be so self-absorbed that you forget the rights of others. And if you have the good qualities, you will be able to have more friends. What's better, for you to have bad qualities and more friends, or to have good qualities and no friends, or to have good qualities and more friends? The answer here is for you to have good qualities and more friends. We can't say, it's wrong for us to say, as Muslims, according to our teachings, that, well, I won't be able to fulfill the correct rights of friends and associates and people who I interact with, and therefore the best thing to do is for me to just completely avoid interacting with people. This is wrong kind of attitude, and it's not something that Islam approves of. We need to mix, we need to mingle, we need to interact, but at the same time, we always need to make sure that we are observing the rights of who we are interacting with. When we see this kind of rights, we are able to understand that the nature of mixing that makes our interaction even better is the intention that we have. Just going to go for a short break, and we will be back very soon.
Allahumma salli wa sallim ala rasooli wa alin nabiyil azim. Allahumma salli wa sallim ala rasooli wa alin nabiyil azim.
Welcome back, dear listeners. And we're talking about intention with who it is that you are interacting with. You know, it might be a very quick encountering, but at the same time, you need to make sure that you leave a good impression, a positive impression, which is the very point that Imam As-Sajjad, peace be upon him, is saying. Because You know, even though you want your own benefits and you want to make sure that these benefits are looked into, you don't want to be an opportunist. You don't want to leave any kind of negative behavior. You don't want to lose your moral standards just for the sake of you getting what it is that you want. Cutting in line is wrong. Mistreating someone in the public is wrong. Those people who you are interacting with, for whatever purpose it may be, if you do so with pride, with haughtiness, with takabbur, that's also going to be wrong. If you're going to treat them like an enemy, that's also going to be wrong. And that's why, towards the end, Imam Sajjad, peace be upon him, he says, وَإِنْ اطْمَأَنَّ إِلَيْكَ اسْتَقْصَيْتَ عَلَىٰ نَفْسِكَ وَعَلِمْتَ أَنَّ غُبْنَ الْمُسْتَرْسِلِ riba. And basically, this means that when you come to realize that they trust you, then try with your utmost ability to gain their trust and to keep their trust. And you need to always remember that the breaching of trust is a kind of usury, is a kind of riba. And of course, that's not good in any way. Al-mustarsil here means the person who is dealing with those who are in their company, in their proximity, because they're relying on you. They want to make sure that you are doing this in the best way. Riba means, the reason why the word usury is used, it's kind of like shock treatment to give you the realization of how bad it is if you are going to betray or deceive or do any of these bad things. You don't want to show off. You don't want to do something wrong. You don't want to retaliate. You don't want to wish bad for someone. You want to make sure that you do everything that is of the highest standards for that person. And you need to gain their trust, and you need to make sure that people know that you are an honorable person, you're a positive person, you're someone who can be trusted. And this is exactly what Imam Sajjad, peace be upon him, is trying to say here. When you're interacting with people, give off a good image. Make sure that you keep your highest standards. Imam Sajjad is saying you're referring to something which you don't need to overlook. Maybe you might say that, you know, this could be difficult or hard or anything like that, but Islam says have as much relations as possible, and at the same time be careful and cautious that you don't tread over anyone's rights. Keep your standards as high as you can. Please visit us on the website of www.pastoday.com, or you're able to email us on englishradio@irib.ir. Until our next program here for humanity in the IRIB English Radio, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
صل يا ربي على طه الأمين رحمة أرسلته للعالمين وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا.
European News Bulletin.
Hello everyone, we're coming to you from the British capital here in London. My name's Amina Taylor, and we start with our top story. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has downplayed the international reaction following the arrest of Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny. Navalny was detained after arriving from Berlin on Sunday, where he was treated following an alleged nerve agent poisoning back in August.
We can see how they jumped at yesterday's news about Navalny's return to Russia, and we can see how gladly the comments, which replicate one another, are being done. They are doing so happily, as it looks like Western politicians view this as an opportunity to draw attention away from the deepest crisis the liberal development model has found itself in.
Navalny's detention was widely expected, as the critic of the Kremlin had violated parole terms from a suspended sentence dating back to a 2014 embezzlement conviction. Under the terms of his parole, he was required to return to Russia after his treatment in Germany, but this was delayed for over 2 months. Navalny will now serve 30 days in prison and will be required to continue abiding by the rules of his parole. Well, Mohsen Abbas, political commentator, has been watching this one keenly. And Mohsen, I mean, Navalny must have known that he would have been arrested on his return. Was this a nice bit of show for the Western audience here?
I think so. Alexei Navalny is simply a puppet within a sort of Western game of actually trying to disrupt and put Russia in an internal, if you like, issue. He does have a considerable following. Again, one has to beg the question how on earth he got such a massive following on social media. I mean, just an anti-corruption campaigner, really. That's all he was. But he's turned into this figurehead, which, again, is it smacks of, color revolution-style operations in the background to boost this individual. And, of course, this provides them yet another opportunity to really highlight him and to put the Russians under pressure. But of course, really, the real backdrop to this is the downward spiral in Russian and European or Western relations ever since the Ukrainian Crimean interference by the Western regimes. And of course, Russia's response to that has been also to put down the similar color revolutions they've been trying to orchestrate in Belarus. And at the same time, this Alexei Navalny issue is thrown up as yet another quite comical, if you like, saga, which serves that kind of cyber warfare suppression of Russian, if you like, reemergence. What with their support with China building up the Eurasian alliances, their reemergence in Middle Eastern politics successfully, and across Africa as well. This is troubling for the Western democracies, which actually Mr. Lavrov has pointed out is the fundamental problem. They're so insecure with their own performances in their own sort of neoliberal so-called democracies that they have to constantly be trying to find ways.
Indeed, and Mohsen, very quickly here, you touched on a couple of the things that you so wisely mentioned there, including the fact that this can be quite a distraction technique. But can you imagine Moscow trying to dictate the UK's terms here, which is essentially what the West wants to do with Russia?
It's unthinkable, because of course they do from time to time blame the Russians for interfering in the election processes of America. Even in Britain, they sort of intimated it with Jeremy Corbyn. So they do try to put these allegations on the Russians. They also, I mean, the Financial Times put out a whole article, I think a little while back, accusing the Russians of having relations with the right wing in Europe. So essentially saying that Russia is fomenting the right-wing movements across Europe, which is it's laughable, really, to the extent that the Russians won't have that degree of influence within sort of fascist-style politics, which opposes their kind of philosophy in the first place. But really, all of this is ultimately their fear that Russians' growing influence in Eurasia, with all of the recent Azerbaijan and Armenia, if you like, peace that they evolved, their relations with Turkey building up, say, the S-400, their relations with Iran and Syria, all of this is concerning the Westerners. Biden is coming in, and they've obviously fired a few salvos already now. NSA incoming Jake Sullivan.
Those are, in fact, pertinent points to watch, and we'll continue to do so. Mohsen, thank you, as always. Mohsen Abbas there for us. And we move to some other news now, because with infection soaring, governments in the United Kingdom and across Europe are desperately trying to get a handle on the pandemic through measures like national lockdowns and mass immunization programs. In Britain, where the